thanks for the introduction. And also for me, it's a big pleasure to be here. And it's also a big honor, I would say, that I was asked to give this introduction to Bohmian Mechanics at this place. I was at the first of these conferences 18 years ago when I was still a student, so a diploma student. I did not even finish my undergrads, and I remember at that time I was extremely enthusiastic and impressed by Bohmian Mechanics, which I just learned a few months before I came here. And I was somewhat surprised that at a conference like this, where many experts on foundations are present, so many people were so, let's say there were still so many misunderstandings about the theory, about what Bohmian Mechanics says and how it works. And now, 18 years later, I think the situation has changed rather little. I mean, I'm still very enthusiastic about the theory, and there's still a lot of misunderstandings about how the theory works and what the theory says around. So the goal of this presentation today is to focus on one particular aspect of Bohmian Mechanics, and it's the aspect which I think is most important to appreciate the theory, namely how Bohmian Mechanics explains in a very simple and natural way the usual textbook quantum mechanical measurement formalism. So my talk will be basically only about this question, and since there's a lot to say about this, and since I have only 40 minutes, I have to skip a lot of other material. So Jörg will be happy to hear that I will skip all the comments on history, because I don't have the time and there are people knowing it better. Actually, I will go so far, I will even not mention the names of the people who did what I'm saying till the very end. So I will give credits in the end and try to first tell you the whole story without mentioning dates and people. And I guess since everybody is aware that everything I'm talking about is not my own work, it's maybe okay to shift the credits to the end. Okay, so what is Bohmian Mechanics about? I mean, I should introduce the theory first. As you all know, it's a non-relativistic theory about the motion of point particles. Point particle meaning it's just an object which is fully characterized by its location in space. So the law of motion, which I will show you in a second, is a first-order differential equation. So at least from a mathematical point of view, it's very natural to formulate a theory on configuration space. Where configuration space, you know, all know what it is, just to introduce notation, if you have a system of capital N particles, the configuration of the particle of this system will be the vector in R3n given by all the positions of the n capital N particles. And the output of the theory will be the positions of all particles at all times. So providing appropriate initial data, I will say what the initial data are in a second, the output of the theory is a trajectory in configuration space, or from my point of view, completely equivalent, the positions of all the particles in the system. So that's what the theory gives you, positions of particles. You could even say that's the only output of the theory. Maybe it's better to say that's the primary output of the theory, but I would like to stress that everything else, what you would like to, properties you think these particles should also have, like velocities, momenta, or energies, or spin, these are all secondary things in this theory which must be deduced from the positions, which are the primary output. Okay, so what are the equations of motion? The law of motion for the Bohmian configurations of the positions of the particles is a first order ODE. And so the derivative of the capital Q, which is the true configuration of the Bohmian particles, is prescribed by a vector field on configuration space. And this vector field on configuration space is generated by another function, by the wave function, which is a function on configuration space taking values in the complex numbers or some spinner space if you have particles with spin. And we assume that, it's part of the theory to assume that psi is a solution of the Schrödinger equation. And I didn't even write out what this operator H here is. It's just the Schrödinger equation, you know, from non-relativistic quantum mechanics for n particles. Is there a question? Right. I mean, take any, okay, I wanted to skip these things because I wanted to get to the more interesting things, but you take whatever you take for an n-particle system in quantum mechanics, with or without potentials, magnetic fields, and then if you take magnetic fields, you would have to adjust this formula. Okay. And, but another way of putting this formula is to say you take the quotient, you take the quantum probability current on configuration space and divided by the probability density. Okay, so these are the equations of motion for the theory. So, saying it again, the structure of the theory is that you have a function on configuration space, the wave function, satisfying Schrödinger's equation. This function generates a vector field on configuration space, and the integral curves to this vector field are the possible Bohmian trajectories. So it's like a bit like in classical Hamiltonian mechanics, which is second order, so you formulate it on phase space. But again, there you have a function on phase space, the Hamiltonian function. It generates a vector field, the Hamiltonian vector field, and the possible trajectories, classical trajectories, are the integral curves to that vector field. So it's similar in this respect. And in particular, the initial data you have to prescribe are the initial configuration of the system at time zero and the initial wave function. Then you can first solve Schrödinger's equation to get the wave function at all times. You compute your vector field on configuration space. You find the integral curve starting in your initial configuration, and you get the configuration for all times. So the particle positions for all times. So with these initial data, it's a deterministic theory. And in a sense, this, you could say this is all. I mean, now we have to start analyzing these equations of motion. We have to see what the equations say, what the empirical predictions of the equations say, and the only freedom we still have is to choose initial conditions. Yeah? At the moment, they are. Yes. I mean, I will say something about this, but you should think of them being, for the moment, for the theory as I presented it up to now, you should think of them being independent. Later on, I will discuss exactly this point, so I think there's no point in answering your question now. Okay, so we would like to understand the empirical predictions of the theory, and actually the rest of the talk will be about this question, so I will start very slowly, very simple, maybe even naive examples, and get hopefully in the end to the final point. So let's start with a very simple example with this double slit experiment where our system consists of one particle only in two-dimensional space. And it propagates through a screen with two slits, and a stationary solution of the Schrödinger equation might maybe look at least schematically like this. I hope you can see it. I mean, on the screen it looks much better, I'm sorry. Here are the two slits, and here you see some parts of the wave function building up this interference pattern. So, given such a solution of the Schrödinger equation, you can compute the corresponding Bohmian trajectories by computing the velocity vector field and computing some integral curves. So for this wave function, you get a whole set of integral curves, of course, infinitely many, only some are shown here, and they correspond to different initial positions for the particle. Okay, so let's now try to use this theory, Bohmian mechanics, for one particle to explain the experimental facts about the double slit experiment. So actually here this should be the wave function and below the trajectories. If you do the experiment, so you prepare one particle, send it through the slit, and you you prepare it in such a way that it has this wave function. What you observe is, and you put a photographic plate behind the screen, you see that whenever you do the experiment, you will get a dot on the screen. So, and if you repeat the experiment, you will see that somehow, although you always prepare the same initial wave function, the dots on the screen are random. So to explain it with Bohmian mechanics, okay, you would say perfectly, the dots fit very well with the trajectories. And to explain the pattern of the dots, that the dots are random, we just have to assume that the initial positions of the particle have been random too. And if we do enough statistics, we get a clear picture of the empirical distribution of the dots. And we can ask ourselves, using the theory, what would have been the distribution of the initial data to produce this pattern. And the distribution of the initial data leading to this pattern is what you all know. It's the what is called in Bohmian mechanics the quantum equilibrium distribution. And assuming that the initial positions of the particles are distributed according to this distribution is called the quantum equilibrium hypothesis. It's a statistical hypothesis assuming that whenever a system has wave function psi, note that I put a little psi here, then its configuration is random with distribution given by the measure with the psi squared density. So that would be a statistical hypothesis analogous to, in classical statistical mechanics, you would say, okay, I have a system in equilibrium with some, I know the energy is E, so I would say the microscopic phase space point of the system is random with distribution given by the microcanonical ensemble. A statistical hypothesis of this type. Okay, so it's a very simple, at least on a formal level, a very simple fact that this distribution, this psi squared distribution, is equivariant, meaning that if you start with a distribution of particles given by the measure with density psi of 0 squared, and you transport this measure along the Bohmian flow, along the Bohmian trajectories, at time t you will end up with a distribution given by the psi of t squared measure, if psi is a solution of the Schrödinger equation. And from this you deduce that you have to assume the quantum equilibrium hypothesis only at one time, let's say the initial time. And then it will hold for all times because of this equivariance property of the measure. So in a sense, this means that the quantum equilibrium hypothesis at one time implies Born's rule for the distribution of positions for all times. And from this, if you predict the distribution of positions, you predict the outcomes of all experiments, at least if you ask that the result of an experiment should be grounded in the configuration of something. Okay. So this is what I would call the naive view on Bohmian mechanics. The naive way of telling, or this very simplified way of telling how Bohmian mechanics explains the quantum probabilities. And for the remaining time, I would like to elaborate on this and explain what you should really say here and how Bohmian mechanics really works. And I will also explain what is somehow problematic with the view I presented you now. So the first thing, or the most important thing to say, is this quantum equilibrium hypothesis is not very precisely formulated, because we refer here to the wave function of a small system, and then we're going to make an experiment with this system. That means we're going to put it into contact with some apparatus, with some environment, let some dynamical stuff happen, and in the end we read off some pointer position, or maybe some ink on a paper, or some spot on a screen, or some photograph of a track in a cloud chamber, or some simulation of that, but we read it off somewhere. And since pointers are easy to draw, I will use pointers too. Okay. But certainly the idea that we should, what I did in the double slit experiment, that we should describe this one single system using Bohmian mechanics for this system only and forget about the rest of the world is certainly very naive. Yeah? No. I would not. Okay. So let's go on, and may I postpone the question to the end, because now I actually emphasize that I'm still talking about something which has to be better understood. Okay. So the problem, or one problem, is that the wave function of a subsystem of a bigger system is not really well defined a priori. So in the formulation of the theory of Bohmian mechanics, there's one wave function for all the n particles. And if we do an experiment with these particles, we should take into account, into our theoretical description, everything which is relevant to the experiment. So in the end, we should start with the wave function of the universe. Whoever feels uncomfortable with the notion of wave function of the universe, you just think of the wave function of everything which is relevant to your experiment. For the following argument, that's as good. Okay, so we start with the wave function of everything that is relevant, what I call now the universe, and a Bohmian description of this big system. And now the question is, what could be meant by the wave function of a subsystem? And first of all, what is a subsystem? A subsystem of an n particle system is just some set of these subset of these n particles. And to distinguish the subsystem particles from all the rest, we call, as usual, the coordinates of the subsystem particles by x and the coordinates of all the rest by y, and the rest we call the environment. Now, in Bohmian mechanics, there's a very simple and straightforward way to define the a wave function, an object which has the looks of a wave function for the subsystem alone. And that's basically the crucial definition here, the so-called conditional wave function of the subsystem. And you get it by taking the wave function of your Bohmian universe. That's the wave function which is used, I mean, which is used by the theory that appears in the Bohmian description of the whole system. And into the y slot, I mean, this is a function on the big configuration space, into the y slot, you just plug in the true configuration of the environment, the true y coordinates. You normalize, and you get a function which depends only on x, on the subsystem coordinates, and on time. And that's the conditional wave function. That's a very good observation. Let me answer this question. For making this definition, I assume that the particles in the environment have no spin. But I am very happy to explain you in the question sessions how it looks with spin. It's only to make, I want to make a very simple point which is often misunderstood. I don't want to clutter it by terrible notation and so on. So let me just answer your question in the very end, how to do it with spin. But if I do it with spin, it will be less obvious. It will be more difficult to understand, and there will be more misunderstanding. So let me take spin of the environment out of the question. But let's say the X particles might still have spin. And it's a very simple, I mean, okay, now you can ask, I can make this definition. But why should it be relevant? So the first observation, which is basically, if you write down the old formula again, it's quite obvious, is that you can now use the conditional wave function to compute the velocity of the subsystem particles. So the x dot is actually given, of course, by the Bohmian guiding law with this wave function, but you can compute the x dot also from the conditional wave function by actually exactly the same formula as before. You can do that. And so it's tempting to think of the subsystem now as its own little Bohmian system with its own Bohmian configuration and its own wave function, the conditional wave function. Now, of course, the question is, will the conditional wave function satisfy also a Schrödinger equation? And the answer is sometimes yes and sometimes no. Because the conditional wave function, the object defined in this way, does exactly what the quantum mechanical wave function of a system is supposed to do. What is it supposed to do if the system is isolated, is not in contact with an environment or a measurement device or whatever? It solves its own little Schrödinger equation. But if it interacts with its environment, the typical thing which will happen with a conditional wave function is that it collapses. I didn't say what I mean by isolated. I will give the details in a second. I mean, I want to slowly get to the point. Okay. These are not meant yet mathematical precise statement. This is meant to give you an idea how to think about the conditional wave function. It's meant, you should imagine that whenever you have a quantum mechanical wave function for a subsystem solving a Schrödinger equation, then also the conditional wave function of Bohmian mechanics will solve the same Schrödinger equation. And whenever you make a measurement in the naive textbook formalism, an ideal measurement or a realistic measurement, the conditional wave function will generically, you can analyze. I mean, it's just defined by the equations for psi and for y, so you can just compute what it does, but I claim generically it will collapse. And the most important point, the quantum equilibrium hypothesis is actually, I will formulate this also more precisely later on, is actually a hypothesis about the conditional wave function and not about the wave function of the full Bohmian universe. Okay, now I'm a bit slower than expected. But in contrast to the usual textbook quantum mechanics wave function, which evolves unitarily, then collapses, evolves unitarily, and so on. This here is just defined by this formula up there. Okay, and now I would like to explain to you why you should expect that this is true in general by discussing a very simple example, namely the paradigmatic example of a quantum measurement, the Stern-Gerlach experiment. Okay, and again, I will start discussing this experiment first from the view of textbook quantum mechanics and from the view of Bohmian mechanics, just for a single particle, just for the subsystem alone. So it will be, again, the naive view, so don't protest yet. And then I will, again, elaborate on that. Okay, so in the Stern-Gerlach experiment, we have a particle with spin, this with position x, and this green blob here is supposed to be the support of the wave function of the particle. You let it go through a inhomogeneous magnetic field, and the Schrödinger evolution will tell you, you can just compute solve Schrödinger's equation, will tell you that for appropriate initial psi, the wave packet will split in two parts, one going to the left, one going to the right. So this is what you get from solving Schrödinger's equation. Now, in textbook quantum mechanics, we would now say if we made a measurement of the position of the particle up here, if we look whether it goes to the left or to the right, we would get a result. Somehow the pointer would point either to the left or to the right. The point is only a symbol. It's easy to draw, okay? And then we would say, okay, if the measurement device, the classical device, would show that the particle went to the left, we should, for all further measurements on this particle, use only this part of the wave function. We should collapse the wave function to get the probabilities for future experiments correct. We now have to start, if we start at time zero with our measurement formalism, we have as an input, we have to use this collapsed wave function. Okay, now let's look at the naive Bohmian view of this experiment. In addition to the wave function, which is exactly the same as for the quantum mechanical treatment, we have the position of the particle, which is somewhere in the wave packet, and the Bohmian guiding law is such that actually the position stays within one of these wave packets, and it might, for example, go to the left. And if we have built a good position measurement device, more on this in a second, then the pointer should point to the left where the particle went. If it doesn't, then it's just not a good measurement of the Bohmian position. Okay, so but actually in this point of view, we also, if we now go on with this Bohmian description of the system as a single system, forgetting about the environment, we have to take into account that the position was measured and we have to collapse the wave function as well. So if you make a quantum equilibrium hypothesis for the subsystem wave function phi, we better use this phi for all future experiments. Okay, so some people claim we also have to collapse the wave function Bohmian mechanics, and in this naive picture, this is of course correct. So for different initial position, however, the particle might have gone to the other direction, and in a good position measurement, the pointer should point to the right, and then again, we would collapse the wave function to the right part and use this for the future Bohmian description. Okay, so this was, as I said, the naive version of the whole story. Now let's look at the same experiment on configuration space of the full system. So system x coordinates plus environment, the y coordinates. So this is, of course, only a very rough sketch of configuration space, but there will be regions in y configuration space where the pointer points left, where the point is neutral, or where the pointer points right. And if we build a good experiment, the Schrödinger evolution should look like, schematically, like the following. As long as the system and the apparatus do not interact, the apparatus will stay in the neutral position, and just the green thing in the previous slides will split into two parts. But then, if we interact with the measurement device in a good position measurement, the wave function, the Schrödinger evolution, will drive the wave function into a region where, of configuration space, where the pointer position is left and the particle went to the left, and the other way around. Okay. Okay, so there's nothing strange about this picture that we have a part here and a part here. If you would make a classical description of this experiment and you would start with the classical probability distribution of initial conditions, it might well be happened that your distribution ends up in really disjoint areas, macroscopically distinct areas of configuration space. And also the picture does not change if we take, at least not qualitatively, if we take more of the environment into account. Okay, if we add, for example, the observer in the laboratory, or if you add the air in the laboratory, or the whole universe, the picture will always stay the same as long as we don't change the linear Schrödinger evolution, okay? And we can also replace pointers by cats, and the picture will still be exactly the same. And again, also a classical Schrödinger cat experiment will drive an initial probability distribution into a distribution having support in dead and in live cats. Okay, so how does the same experiment, the same thing look now if we, from the view of textbook quantum mechanics, when we try to follow the evolution of the subsystem wave function? So what is the subsystem wave function? To have a subsystem wave function, we usually assume that the initial state is a product of a wave function for this system and a wave function for all the rest. Okay, and then here in this drawing, the blue thing is again the wave function is the wave function of everything of x and of the whole system. It lives on the whole configuration space, and the green factor lives only on this x-axis. So that's why I draw it like this. So it's a 1D function. Okay, so if we let the Schrödinger evolution go, as long as we have no appreciable interaction with the environment, the product structure will stay intact, and we can still speak about the subsystem wave function as this factor here. And these two green bumps are exactly the two green bumps we saw on the previous slide. This psi here, this factor, will solve its own Schrödinger equation if there's no interaction with the environment. But if we have the interaction with the apparatus, the Schrödinger evolution of the full system will get entangled, and there the product structure is lost, so it's not clear how to define the wave function of the subsystem. And it's also not clear, just from the Schrödinger evolution, even on the big system, what the outcome of the experiment is. The blue, the solution of Schrödinger's equation, will still not tell us the outcome. We still have to say, okay, we have to read off the measurement device. We see, for example, that the pointer points left, and then we will collapse the wave function to the part which agrees with our observation. We forget about the rest, but once we have done this, we are again in the position where we have our subsystem, collapsed subsystem wave function as the X factor in this product. So this is the quantum mechanical description on the full configuration space, and now let's look at it from a Bohmian view. First of all, let's just look at the full wave function with the Bohmian configuration of X and Y. And, okay, not surprisingly, the configuration will follow one of these two packets. And indeed, in Bohmian mechanics, the final configuration will tell us whether the pointer points left or to the right. If we start somewhere else, the configuration might go with the other packet. Okay, nothing surprising about that yet. And now comes the slide, which is the reason why I made this whole animation, because I would like to explain you now the role of the conditional wave function in Bohmian mechanics. So it would be very nice if everybody could try to understand this slide. Okay, so we start again in this idealized case with the product wave function for the system, the same as before. And now the first thing is actually the conditional wave function of Bohmian mechanics is exactly this first factor, so it agrees in this case with the quantum mechanical wave function we would associate with the system. Yeah, we just plug in here the configuration of the environment and we normalize. This is always equality up to normalization. I didn't want to put it all on the slides, okay? And we get this prefactor here, this green thing. So how can we imagine in this picture how to get the conditional wave function? Yeah, we take the blue thing here, we look at the true Bohmian configuration, and we fix the y coordinates. So we cut through the hyperplane given by y equal capital Y of t, and we get we restrict the blue function to this hyperplane, and we get this green bump here. That's the conditional wave function. So what does it do if we let the evolution go? So we just have to cut at the y coordinate where the Bohmian particle is. So as long as we don't interact with the environment, as long as this product structure remains intact, let me finish the sentence. If we cut through here, we see these two bumps. So the conditional wave function will still agree with the quantum mechanical wave function, and it will solve, at least approximately, its own Schrödinger equation. It does. No, I mean, it didn't move in time here because it was very difficult for me to do this animation at all. It's you might imagine that it wiggles around a bit, but if you cut through this product wave function and normalize, the green thing will always be the same. Okay? It's just my skills that were not sufficient to make the Y wiggle also. But now the Y will change. Okay? This was the part where we have no interaction. This is where the part where the conditional wave function solves the Schrödinger equation. Now comes the part where the conditional wave function does not solve a Schrödinger equation. I guess now you can see what happens, or before I start the animation, the Y changes, the environment, we get entanglement with the environment, and the conditional wave function is still well defined. I mean, it's just defined by this formula. The state is not a product anymore, And you see, if you cut through here, you get the collapsed wave function. That was exactly the quantum mechanical collapsed wave function after the measurement. Okay? So the conditional wave function, if we start with another initial position, maybe the particle goes to the right. As long as the y doesn't change, doesn't leave really the support here, it can wiggle a bit. This will be a solution of a Schrödinger equation. And as soon as we have interaction with the environment, the conditional wave function collapses. But it's not that we define it to collapse because we made a measurement, but it just does what it does, which is told to us by the equations of motions for psi and for y. Okay. So it's really important, if you think about Bohmian mechanics, to keep in mind that there are two kinds of wave function. There is the wave function, the blue one, the wave function of the universe, of everything, which defines the theory, in a sense, which defines the motion of the particles, which solves the Schrödinger equation always. It never collapses, it's just a solution of Schrödinger's equation. But if you want to describe the behavior of subsystems of Bohmian systems, and you would like to describe measurements on subsystems, you can use, and we all know that it's very useful, the quantum formalism, you can use the wave function of a subsystem, but this is the conditional wave function of the subsystem, and that will, in general, behave in a much more complicated way. It will evolve according to Schrödinger's equation for isolated systems and collapse if you interact with the environment. So there are two types of wave functions, but the motion of this point here is, of course, defined by the blue wave function, but equivalently, that's just a mathematical equivalence, you can use the green wave function to define the motion. They will give the same motion. Okay. So in particular, there is no jumping of trajectories because of collapse of conditional wave function or anything like that. Okay, so let's finish with the reformulation of the quantum equilibrium hypothesis. And okay, so as I said, the quantum equilibrium hypothesis is a hypothesis about the conditional wave functions, about subsystems having certain conditional wave functions. So one way to formulate it, and I hope my colleagues will not protest too much, to make it very short and quick, is to say the following. What we really would like to understand is why in one laboratory doing the experiment with a double slit, in one laboratory sending many different particles at different times through this double slit, getting the positions of different particles, so of different subsets on the screen, why the empirical distribution of these configurations or positions is given by the square of the conditional wave function. But all of this happens within, at least according to this theory, all this happens within one realization of the realization of the laboratory, one realization of the world. Okay, so we live basically in one realization of a Bohmian universe specified by the initial wave function of the universe and specified by the initial configuration. So according to this theory, everything else is determined from now, but still we observe randomness within this one realization. And what we would like to explain is why, if we look at the configurations of subsystems, at different subsystems possibly, at different times, why the empirical distribution of these subsystem configurations, or positions, is given by the square of the conditional wave function. So why, if all these subsystems at different times share the same conditional wave function, why is the empirical distribution of their positions given by the conditional wave function? And to explain this, we could just postulate, we could just say this is now the hypothesis. It's a hypothesis on the initial data saying, okay, our universe had an initial datum such that the empirical distributions within this realizations are of that type. That's a hypothesis we can make. Then we explain why we see these empirical distributions. using the theory once we made the hypothesis. And now the remaining question is, are there actually initial conditions such that within the corresponding version realization of the Bohmian universe, the empirical distributions are of that type? And the answer is very satisfactory and also not too difficult to really prove mathematically. The answer is, I just wanted to show first, okay, the picture again. Many different subsystems producing different dots on the screen within one Bohmian universe, but the empirical distribution here should be close to the conditional wave function, which it's the same for all these subsystems. Okay, but the statement one can now show is that in a Bohmian universe with any initial wave function sufficiently regular so that the dynamics is well defined, the set, this hypothesis that the subsystem distributions, empirical distributions of subsystems configuration are given by phi squared, this hypothesis holds for typical initial data, not only for some very special, but for typical initial data, where typical means that the set of initial data for which you would have empirical reason to dismiss this statistical hypothesis, that the set of initial data where you would dismiss this hypothesis is a small set. It has small measure in the following sense, it has small capital psi squared measure. So in a sense, coming back to the question from the beginning, this basically tells you that if you start with an initial condition in the support of the wave function for the Bohmian universe, you're very likely to see in the end a universe which behaves according to quantum mechanical statistics. Okay, so again in one sentence, in a typical Bohmian universe, the quantum measurement formalism gives the correct empirical predictions. Okay, so I'm almost done. As I promised, I just flash very briefly a few names. Okay, as you all probably know, the first one to write down this guiding law was de Broglie in 1927. And although I'm not really familiar with the history, I think it's safe to say that if he would have understood everything I told you now, he would not have given up so readily this theory. Then David Bohm rediscovered it in 1952, and I would say that he basically understood most of the points and even wrote them down very clearly, I told you today. So he really worked out and understood the theory. Then John Bell did a lot of advertising on Bohmian mechanics, but also emphasized, for example, that it is more natural to think of Bohmian mechanics as a theory on configuration space instead of phase space. You all heard of the quantum potential, which David Bohm used to put the theory on phase space. And then the concept of conditional wave function and the statement I just mentioned about the typicality of quantum equilibrium was actually proved and worked out by Detlef Dirsch, Sheldon Goldstein, and Nino Zangi in 1992. So with this, I would like to thank you very much for your attention.